If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
England in 1860 was a nation obsessed with respectability. Gas lamps flickered in drawing rooms across the countryside, casting long shadows on walls papered in floral prints and family portraits. Behind heavy curtains and locked doors, Victorian families performed their daily rituals of propriety, tea, and social hierarchy. The outside world saw polished brass door knockers and manicured gardens. Inside, secrets festered in silence. Road Hill House stood three stories tall in the village of Road, Wiltshire, about 100 miles west of London. The mansion belonged to Samuel Saville Kent, a factory inspector for the Home Office, who earned roughly £400 annually inspecting compliance with child labor laws. He lived there with his second wife, three young children, and two teenage children from his first marriage, who came home from boarding school for the summer. Nine people in total, plus household staff. High walls and locked gates surrounded the property. An outdoor privy, or outhouse, sat in the back garden, 30 yards from the house. On June 30th, 1860, those walls couldn't keep a secret any longer. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. In the early morning hours of that June day, someone entered the nursery on the second floor of Road Hill House, lifted three-year-old Francis Saville Kent from his cane cot, carried him down two flights of stairs across the garden in the dark, and killed him in that outdoor privy. The boy's throat was slashed so deeply, he was nearly decapitated. His small body was stuffed into that privy vault beneath the toilet seat, wrapped in a flannel blanket from his own nursery. Francis was called Saville by his family, his father's favorite child, a pleasant boy who went to bed around 8 o'clock every evening and woke up smiling. The killer came from inside the house. That much was certain. No one had broken in. The doors were locked. The windows latched from the inside. One of the nine people sleeping in Road Hill House that night had committed murder. And it would take 5 years, a destroyed detective's career, and a confession born from religious torment before England learned the truth.
To understand how murder entered Road Hill House, you have to understand how the Kent family broke in half long before that June night. Samuel Saville Kent married his first wife, Mary Ann Windus, on June 8, 1829. She came from a prosperous London family. Her father owned a successful coachmaking business with money and connections in the city. The marriage produced 10 children between 1829 and 1845. Four died in infancy. Mary Ann endured pregnancy after pregnancy, year after year, until her body and her mind began failing. By the early 1840s, Mary Ann suffered from what Victorian doctors called bewilderment of intellect. She experienced delusions, couldn't care for her children. Samuel hired a governess to manage the home and raise the surviving children. Mary Ann, Alice, Elizabeth, Edward, Constance, and William. The governess was named Mary Drew Pratt, 24 years old, attractive, capable, and younger than the exhausted ill wife upstairs. Mary Pratt became mistress of the house in every respect except name. Neighbours in the Wiltshire community gossiped about the arrangement. The scandal forced the family to move repeatedly. When Mary Ann Kent died in May 1852, at the age of 44, Samuel observed barely a year of mourning. He married Mary Pratt in August 1853. 15 months after his first wife's death, he made his children's former governess their new mother. 9-year-old Constance Emily Kent served as bridesmaid at her father's wedding to the woman who had replaced her mother. What followed was systematic erasure. The second Mrs. Kent bore 3 children in quick succession: Mary Amelia in 1854, Frances Saville in August 1856, and Evelyn in 1858. These 3 children became the favoured family. They received their parents' attention, affection, and resources. The first wife's surviving children became inconveniences to be hidden away. Constance's older siblings had left home by this point, escaping to marriages or other towns. That left Constance and her brother William, teenagers who spent most of the year at boarding school. The household divided into 2 families living under 1 roof, the loved children and the discarded children, the mother's children and the ghost mother's children. Constance watched her father lavish attention on Frances that he'd never given her. She watched her stepmom dote on the boy. She slept in a different wing of the house than her half-siblings. She ate different food. She wore hand-me-downs while Frances wore clothing commissioned from town. When she came home from boarding school for summer holidays, she was tolerated, not welcomed. The summer Constance turned 13, 1857, when William was 11, the 2 siblings ran away. They cut their hair short and disguised themselves as boys, planning to reach Bristol Port, 40 miles away, and somehow sail away to a new life. They made it 9 miles to Bath before being caught at a hotel. Samuel Kent beat them both when they were returned home. Constance was locked in the cellar for 2 days as punishment. She hid the cut hair and boys' clothes in the outdoor privy at the back of the garden, the same privy where 3 years later she would hide something else entirely. By June 1860, Constance was 16 years old. Home from boarding school for the summer, watching her half-brother Francis receiving the love she'd been denied her entire life. Living in a house where her stepmother had systematically erased her real mother's memory. No portraits remained of Mary Ann Kent. No mention of the first wife was permitted. The woman who had borne 6 children simply ceased to exist in the family narrative. Constance endured a father who saw her as a disappointment. Victorian England believed that respectable families didn't produce murderers, that young ladies of good breeding simply didn't commit violence, that the closed doors and high walls of homes like Road Hill House protected innocence and virtue. But doors don't stop rage that's been building for 16 years. Walls don't contain the kind of hatred that grows from systematic rejection. The Kent family wasn't a family. It was a pressure cooker waiting to explode. Before Francis becomes a case file or a plot point in English criminal history, he deserves to be remembered as a child who existed. Francis Saville Kent was born in August 1856, the eldest son of Samuel Kent's second marriage, and the boy his father had always wanted from his first. By June 1860, he was a healthy child who ran through the gardens of Road Hill House, climbed on furniture when no one was watching, and asked constant questions the way children do at that age. Elizabeth Goff, the family's 22-year-old nursemaid, dressed him in the day clothing that had been laid out the night before. He wore a child's frock. Boys that age still wore dresses in Victorian England, with a small jacket when the weather required it. Buttoned boots that he was learning to fasten himself, though he needed help with the top buttons. Breakfast was brought to the nursery at 8 o'clock. Francis ate porridge most mornings, sometimes bread with butter and jam. He drank milk from a small cup he could hold himself. He was learning to use cutlery properly, which meant meals could be messy and required patience from Elizabeth Goff. He liked sweet things, jam, cake, anything with sugar. He didn't like vegetables much. Few children do. Most mornings, weather permitting, Elizabeth took Francis and Evelyn outside to play in the garden. Francis liked being outdoors, He collected stones and showed them to anyone who would look. See this one? It's my favourite. No, wait, this one. He chased butterflies without success. He talked to the family dog, though they didn't own a dog. He simply decided that dogs existed somewhere and should be spoken to. Three-year-olds operate on their own logic. His mother visited the nursery several times each day, more than most upper-class Victorian mothers would. Mary Drew Kent doted on her eldest son, in ways she would never dote on her stepchildren. She held him, read to him, and sang lullabies. Francis called her mama without hesitation. He reached for her whenever she entered the room, asked her to stay longer when she prepared to leave. His father visited less frequently. Samuel Kent's work kept him away from home for days at a time, inspecting factories across England. But when Samuel was home, Francis was his clear favourite in ways that must have cut Constance and William like knives every time they witnessed it. Samuel called him Savile, never Francis. The boy would sit on his father's knee in the study. Samuel taught him to count to 10, which Francis could do if he reminded him to skip 9. He bought him small gifts from his travels, a wooden horse, a painted top, a small book of animal pictures. The household staff liked Francis. He wasn't a difficult child, no worse than any three-year-old, which meant occasional tantrums when tired, but nothing remarkable. He said please and thank you when reminded. He shared toys with his sisters sometimes, though he had to be encouraged. He cried when he fell down or felt sick. Normal childhood responses. Round 4 in the afternoon, Francis had had his tea. More bread, sometimes cake, milk again. Then came his favourite part of the day. An evening walk round the gardens with Elizabeth Gough before sunset. He held her hand. He pointed at birds and clouds. He picked flowers, usually the ones Mary Kent has specifically asked him not to pick, and brought them back to show his mother anyway. His bedtime routine began round 7 o'clock. Bath water was brought to the nursery in a large pitcher. Elizabeth Gough washed Francis and Evelyn in a tiny tub by the fire. She filled it just deep enough that Francis could sit without water going over his shoulders, warm but not too hot. She washed his dark hair with soap that smelt of lavender. She dried him with towels and dressed him in his nightshirt, soft flannel that had been warmed near the fire, and combed his hair smooth. He had a wicker cane cot with a thin mattress and several blankets. He slept with a small stuffed rabbit that had been given to him when he was younger. He couldn't sleep without it. His mother came to kiss him goodnight. She said prayers with him, the simple children's prayers Victorian households required. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. Francis repeated the words without really understanding them the way children do. He asked for water. He asked to stay up longer. He negotiated like a three-year-old, knowing the answer would be no, but trying anyway because sometimes trying worked. By 8 o'clock he was in his cot. Elizabeth Gough sat in the rocking chair nearby until he fell asleep, which usually took 15 or 20 minutes. He talked to himself quietly, told himself stories, asked questions to no one in particular, like, where do stars come from? Why is nighttime dark? Then his voice would slow, soften, then silence. He slept in that nursery every night of his short life. The room was familiar, his blankets, his toys scattered on the floor, his stuffed rabbit, the small table where he took his meals, the window that looked out over the garden where he played. On the night of June the 29th, 1860, Francis Savile Kent went to bed at 8 o'clock as usual. Elizabeth Gough sat with him until he fell asleep. She checked on him once more around 10:30 before retiring to her own small room adjacent to the nursery. The door between the rooms stood open, as it did every night, so she could hear if Francis or Evelyn woke. Francis was sleeping peacefully, his stuffed rabbit tucked under his arm. Sometime between midnight and 5 in the morning, someone entered that nursery. Someone lifted Francis from his cot without him crying out. Someone carried him down 2 flights of stairs, through the dark house, out into the June rain, across the garden to the outdoor privy. Someone held a small boy while slashing his throat so deeply he was nearly decapitated. Someone wrapped his body in his own nursery blanket and stuffed him into the privy vault. Francis Saville Kent was 3 years and 10 months old. He existed. He had a personality, routines, favourite foods, a stuffed rabbit he couldn't sleep without, and people who cared for him. His life mattered beyond the mystery of his death. Someone murdered him anyway.
Friday night, June 29th, 1860. Rain had fallen throughout the week, turning the gardens around Roadhill House muddy and dark. The village of Road had no streetlights. In the countryside, night meant absolute blackness, broken only by oil lamps and candles inside homes. By 9 o'clock, most windows in the village showed no light at all. Inside Roadhill House, the family followed their evening routine. Samuel Kent read in his study. His wife Mary attended to household matters. The older children, Constance, age 16, and William, age 15, home from boarding school for summer holidays, were somewhere in the house. The 3 young children from the second marriage had been put to bed hours earlier. Elizabeth Goff, the nurse, prepared the nursery for the night. She tucked Francis into his small cane cot around 8 o'clock. Baby Evelyn slept in her cot beside him. The 2 cots sat together in the nursery room. The door connecting the nursery to Mr. and Mrs. Kent's bedroom stood partially open, as it did every night. One by one, the household went to bed. Candles were extinguished. Lamps were turned down. Servants retired to their quarters. The family disappeared into their separate rooms. Separate because even in sleep, the first family and second family didn't mix. Sometime between midnight and 5 o'clock in the morning, someone entered that nursery. They moved silently. No doors creaked. No footsteps alerted Elizabeth Goff, sleeping feet away. They lifted Francis from his cot without waking him or his sister. They carried the boy, still in his night clothes, possibly wrapped in the flannel blanket from his cot, through the nursery door, down the hallway, down the servant's staircase, 2 flights to the ground floor. They unlocked the drawing room door from the inside, unlatched the window, crossed 30 yards of dark garden in the June rain to reach the outdoor privy. They had matches with them. Several were found later in the privy, placed there beforehand so the killer could see in the pitch darkness. Inside that privy, they slit Francis Saville Kent's throat. The cut went so deep, it nearly severed his head from his body. Whether he woke, whether he cried out, whether he knew what was happening, these questions have no answers. What's certain is that he died quickly from that wound. His blood spilled onto the privy floor. The killer wrapped his body in the blanket and shoved it down into the vault beneath the toilet seat. Then they went back to the house, relocked the door, climbed back upstairs, returned to their bed. No one heard anything. Not Elizabeth Goff sleeping in the nursery. Not Mr. and Mrs. Kent sleeping in the connecting bedroom with the door partially open. Not the other servants in their quarters. Not Constance or William in their rooms elsewhere in the house. The house full of people slept through a child's murder. When dawn broke on Saturday, June 30th, 1860, Roadhill House looked exactly as it always did. 3 stories of respectable Victorian architecture, locked gates, high walls, a factory inspector's family, beginning another ordinary weekend. But in the nursery, on the second floor, Francis Saville Kent's cot was empty. Elizabeth Goff woke around 7:15 on Saturday morning. Her routine was always the same. Check on the children, prepare them for the day, maintain the orderly schedule that kept the nursery running smoothly. She rose from her bed in the nursery and looked at the two cots beside her. Evelyn slept peacefully. Francis's cot was empty. Goff assumed someone had taken him downstairs early. Mr. or Mrs. Kent sometimes brought Francis to their room in the morning. She checked the connecting door to the parents' bedroom. The door was closed. She remembered it being partially open when they'd gone to bed. That was unusual, but not alarming. She went downstairs to look for Francis. He wasn't in the drawing room, not in the dining room, not with his parents. Goff asked the household staff if they'd seen the boy. No one had. Miss Kent came down, still in her nightclothes. Where was Saville? The confusion turned to concern. The concern turned to panic. By 8 o'clock, the entire household was searching. Every room checked. Every closet opened. Every space a three-year-old boy might hide or wander. He wasn't in the house. Samuel Kent searched the gardens, the grounds, the outbuildings. Someone noticed the drawing room window was unlatched from the inside. Had Francis somehow opened it? Had someone taken him through that window? The possibility of kidnapping emerged. Perhaps someone had broken in, though that made no sense. The window was latched from the inside, meaning whoever opened it had been in the house. 2.5 hours passed. Servants, family members, neighbors who'd been called to help. Everyone searching, increasingly frantic. At approximately 9:45 that morning, Thomas Banger, the husband to the housemaid, checked the outdoor privy at the back of the garden. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Look, the new year doesn't have to mean reinventing yourself. That's exhausting. Maybe it's just about carrying less. For me, that meant letting go of the pressure to have everything figured out. The doubt that whispered I wasn't building something real. Turns out, those weights were heavier than I realized, and I couldn't see how heavy until I had someone outside my own head help me look at them. That's what therapy can do. An unbiased perspective to help you understand what's actually holding you back. Your relationships, your motivations, the stories you tell yourself. BetterHelp has over 30,000 licensed therapists. They've helped more than 5 million people find their footing. They handle the matching work for you. And if your therapist isn't the right fit, you can switch anytime. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com. He lifted the wooden seat covering the vault. Francis Saville Kent's body lay in the privy vault, wrapped in a flannel blanket. His small body was cold. He'd been dead for hours. Banger would later testify to details that made the horror sound somehow worse. The boy's face, he said, looked quite pleasant. His little eyes were shut, as if they were sleeping. But the wound to his throat made clear what had happened. Someone had held Francis Saville Kent, a three-year-old boy who should have been waking up in his cot that morning, and cut his throat with a sharp blade, enough to go through the skin and muscle and windpipe, almost to the spine. The household erupted into chaos. Someone ran for the village constable. Miss Kent became nearly inconsolable. Samuel Kent stood quiet and reserved, appearing more agitated than sad. According to witnesses, the servants clustered together, horrified. Constance and William came down from their rooms to learn their half-brother had been murdered. By late morning, Constable Urch arrived from the village. By afternoon, Superintendent John Foley, from Trowbridge, had taken charge of what would become one of Victorian England's most notorious murder investigations. But in those first hours, one fact became increasingly clear to everyone standing in the garden of Roadhill House. Looking at the outdoor privy 30 yards from the house, where a child's body had just been found. No stranger had done this. The doors had been locked all night. The drawing room window was unlatched from the inside, obviously staged to suggest a break-in. Someone had known exactly where Francis slept, how to move through the house without waking the servants, where to find matches to light the privy. Someone had wrapped him in his own blanket and carried him silently through the dark. The killer lived in Roadhill House. Constable Urch had no forensic training. Nobody in 1860 did. The science of crime scene investigation didn't exist yet. Fingerprinting wouldn't become standard practice for another 40 years. DNA analysis was a century away. Blood typing wasn't understood. Detectives were a new and somewhat suspect profession. Scotland Yard had been founded only 18 years earlier, with just 8 original detective officers. Urch stood in the garden of Roadhill House, looking at a murdered child, and had no idea how to investigate it. He walked through the crime scene without preserving evidence. Multiple people had already contaminated the privy where the body was found. The nursery had been thoroughly searched before anyone thought to protect it as the scene of the abduction. Footprints in the muddy garden, if they existed, were trampled by the dozens of people who'd searched the grounds that morning. Superintendent John Foley arrived from Trowbridge to take over the investigation. He had more authority than Urch, but no more training. And Foley had another problem. Samuel Kent was a government factory inspector, a member of the respectable middle class. Foley would have to tread carefully. Accusing a man of Kent's position of murdering his own son, or protecting whoever did, was career suicide, unless the evidence was overwhelming. So Foley focused on the servants. The inquest opened within days. The coroner questioned household staff under oath. Elizabeth Goff, the nurse, faced intense scrutiny. She'd been sleeping in the nursery. She'd put Francis to bed. She should have heard something. How could someone carry a child from the room without waking her? Goff had no answers that satisfied anyone. Her testimony was consistent, but unconvincing. She'd slept through it all, she said. She heard nothing. The laundress Sarah Cox came forward with evidence that should have changed the investigation's direction. She reported that one of Constance Kent's nightgowns was missing. She counted 3 nightgowns before the wash and found only 2 afterward. One had disappeared. Constable Urch had actually found a blood-stained nightgown in the house during his initial search. When he showed it to Superintendent Foley, Foley dismissed it as menstrual blood. Nothing to do with the murder. The nightgown vanished from evidence. No one could say what happened to it. Samuel Kent's razor went missing, then turned up clean. No one investigated why. The inquest dragged on through July. Samuel Kent and his wife were never questioned under oath. Constance and William were interviewed informally, not under formal examination. The focus remained on servants and the possibility of an intruder, despite mounting evidence that someone inside the family knew exactly what happened. On July 27, 1860, the inquest jury delivered their verdict. Francis Saville Kent had been willfully murdered by person or persons unknown. The verdict meant nothing. Everyone knew the killer was inside the house. The jury just couldn't bring itself to name a member of a respectable family as a murderer. Public outrage grew. Newspapers across England demanded answers. How could a child be murdered in a locked house full of people and no one face justice? How could local police protect a family simply because they had social standing? The pressure forced the Home Office to act. In mid-July, they sent someone from Scotland Yard who wouldn't worry about offending the local gentry. Someone who'd follow the evidence regardless of class. They sent Detective Inspector Jack Witcher. Detective Inspector Jack Witcher arrived at Roadhill House in mid-July 1860. He was 46 years old. One of the 8 original Scotland Yard detective officers appointed in 1842. Colleagues called him Jack. The newspapers called him Prince of Detectives. He'd built his reputation solving impossible cases through methodical observation, forensic attention to detail, and an understanding of criminal psychology that was decades ahead of its time. Witcher came from a working-class origins. His father had been a gardener. He'd risen through the Metropolitan Police through skill and intelligence, not family connections. That background made him brilliant at his job. He understood how criminals thought because he'd grown up around people who struggled to survive. He knew desperation and jealousy and rage. But in the summer of 1860, investigating the Kent family murder, his working-class background would become his fatal flaw. Witcher spent 5 days at Roadhill House examining the crime scene, interviewing servants, reviewing evidence. He reconstructed the murder night timeline. He noted the missing nightgown. He observed how the family interacted. He paid attention to details that local police had missed. And he came to a conclusion that would destroy his career. The crime required inside knowledge. The killer knew where Francis slept, knew the house layout, knew when servants would be asleep, knew where to find matches to light the privy in the dark. The missing nightgown suggested someone who needed to hide blood-stained clothing. The careful staging of the drawing room window showed sophistication in trying to mislead investigators. Witcher identified his prime suspect, Constance Kent. 16 years old, the neglected daughter from the first marriage. The girl who'd run away from home 3 years earlier. The one who'd been systematically rejected in favor of the second family. The one who'd hidden cut hair and boys' clothing in that same outdoor privy years before using it for murder. She had motive. She had opportunity. She had the inside knowledge. And she'd shown capacity for deception during the 1857 runaway attempt. Witcher arrested Constance Kent on July 20th, 1860. The public erupted in fury. How dare this working-class policeman accuse a young lady of good breeding of such a heinous crime? Constance came from a respectable family. She was educated, refined, proper, The very idea that she could slit a three-year-old's throat was monstrous slander from a man who didn't understand class distinctions. The magistrate released Constance after questioning. There wasn't enough evidence to hold her. The missing nightgown was lost. The circumstantial case couldn't overcome Victorian class prejudice. A gentleman's daughter simply couldn't be a murderer, regardless of what evidence suggested. Witcher returned to London. The newspapers savaged him. Local police celebrated his failure. The Kent family retreated behind their walls and their respectability. The case went cold. Francis Saville Kent's murder remained technically unsolved. Constance went back to her life. 5 years would pass before the truth emerged. Not through investigation, but through a confession born from religious torment that Witcher could never have predicted. Jack Witcher had been right all along. He'd solved the case in just 5 days. He'd identified the killer, understood the motive, reconstructed the crime. But in 1860 Victorian England, a working-class detective couldn't accuse a young lady of murder and survive. And it would cost him everything. Until next time, remember, a house full of people slept through a child's murder, but the walls couldn't keep the secret forever. 3-year-old Francis Saville Kent died in the dark of a June night because hatred had festered too long in silence. Sometimes the most dangerous monsters don't break in through windows. They already live inside the house. Thanks for listening, friend.